Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
Hello, I'm Beverly Wang, and welcome to this Melbourne Writers Festival digital event coming to you from the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, as well as all First Nations people and lands from where you're joining in from. And also now a big welcome to the man of the hour, Akala. He's an award-winning, a MOBO and BAFTA award-winning hip-hop artist, performer, lecturer, teacher, writer, author. And we are here today to focus on his latest book, a novel called Dark Lady. Akala, welcome to the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm sorry that we can't do this in person, but these are pandemic times. So this is the way we have to connect these days.
Yeah, no, me too. I did enjoy, I've been to Australia a couple of times and I've had a good time.
Yeah.
And, so it's good.
Let's talk about The Dark Lady. It's your follow-up to Natives from 2018. And I suppose I'd like to hear you begin by talking a little bit about the trajectory from Natives, which is nonfiction, memoir, interwoven with social analysis, political analysis, and history, now to a novel based in a very, very different time, if not place. So how did you travel from Natives to The Dark Lady?
With great difficulty, firstly. It was two. I knew I was doing the novel. Probably, I can't remember when I agreed to do it, but I think I was sort of in the middle of writing Natives or maybe towards the end. So I knew it was coming. Completely different brain space, completely different way of thinking. It's my first novel as well. So it was really, 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 really challenging. And at the beginning of the process, it almost took a couple of months, literally just to switch my brain around from thinking about history and politics to creating scenes and creating worlds. And obviously the novel has a socio-political angle. Like everything I do is very much about class. And obviously it's about race a little bit in the Elizabethan era. But try not to project back today's politics and history and try to deal with the politics of the Elizabethan era based on the evidence of that time. But it's just such a different brain space to create a novel and to think in that way. And it was really, really, really tough to do, but I really, really enjoyed the process in the end and look forward to doing it again.
So when you say you knew it was coming, does that mean that you had a seed of idea? You always, in the back of your head, knew that you wanted to write a novel, or was it some other development when you say you knew it was coming?
I knew I wanted to write a novel, but I also knew that I'd agreed with the publishing company to write this particular novel, if that makes sense. So I knew I had that obligation there, and kind of the way my brain works, if I'm near to completion of one project, I sort of start allocating some brain space to preparation for the next one. Otherwise, it's like I'm starting cold. So I'd started to do little tidbits of research. I knew quite a lot about the Elizabethan era because of the Hip-Hop Shakespeare Company, obviously. And so that was good. So I had a bit of a head start there, but obviously I had to do a mountain of research, which was fun. And that took a little while. And then obviously just craft. I'd never written a novel before. I don't have an English degree, because I didn't go to university. So coming back to those things, obviously I've written quite a few collections of short stories, and I've written two graphic novels. So it's not like I haven't been writing creatively, but the novel format was really, really tough.
And specifically, it's a YA novel. How long have you known that you wanted to write for a younger audience?
My whole adult life, really. I was lucky enough that I had an enormous amount of encouragement at school from my family and from my wider social circle, even though, you know, we were not well off at all, to put it mildly. And I benefited enormously from a kind of rich cultural environment. And so I've always seen the benefit of that for younger people and wanted to be part of promoting that to a new generation of young people, the power of reading, the power of education, the importance of doing well in school and all that sort of stuff. That's been very much part of my brand, so to speak, and I'm still doing that.
So when you start to shift towards thinking about how to write fiction for a younger audience, children and teens, what are the things that you are prioritizing or thinking about that you need to, I suppose, make suitable for that age group?
Funny you should say about suitable. One of the big debates I had with the publishing company during the making of this was about the sex and violence in the book. And I think it's a fine line, because obviously you don't want to put parents off. It's primarily going to be parents buying this kind of book for children, or schools buying this kind of book for children. I also think you don't want to patronize children. I'm from London, right? Teenagers are definitely having sex, and teenagers are being murdered on a regular basis. So, at least in some environments, in some communities in this city. And therefore, they're forced to grow up to the reality of the world very, very early. And I think for art to speak to them, it needs to speak to some of that reality and that understanding of those experiences and that they are capable of getting that. I think obviously there's a level of writing just in terms of complexity, emotional, psychological, intellectual complexity and denseness that is probably more aimed at an adult audience. And I think that's more important, at least for me, than the presence or lack of presence of sex or violence. But, you know, I probably tempered some of it a little bit in a way. I did definitely temper some of it a little bit in a way that I wouldn't have if it was a novel for adults. There are no overt, yeah, there's allusions to people having sex, but there are no overt sex scenes, so to speak, which there probably would be if it was a novel for adults. Somebody does get stabbed in there. But again, the violence probably isn't as visceral and gritty as it might have been if it was a novel for adults. So those are some of the adjustments.
What were some of the formative novels that you read growing up that really have stuck with you and influenced you?
Obviously, Lord of the Rings. So if we're talking about childhood novels, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit was enormous for me, as it really 95% of young people who get into reading in England, because it becomes that book. Of Mice and Men, they do Of Mice and Men at GCSE. And I don't think I really appreciated it fully at the time. It was only as years went by, I looked back on my GCSE. I had a really good English teacher, and I really enjoyed that book. There's a book called The Runaways. The author's name does escape me. But that was a great YA book that I remember. But younger, the Roald Dahl stuff was huge for me. Those are sort of the standout ones that I remember thinking, yeah, I really, really enjoyed that. Was Of Mice and Men, was Lord of the Rings, was some of the Roald Dahl stuff a bit earlier. And this particular book, The Runaways. Oh, Salman Rushdie did a book a YA called Harun and the Sea of Stories. And that really stuck with me. Our teacher, Ann Taylor, who was like my favorite teacher in primary school, she read us from that book. And I really remember that. And that was great.
Every time I read a YA novel, I always think to myself, this is, I get so much of it out of it as a grown up. And I think to myself, more adults should read YA. There's so many themes that they can pick up from, and the stories are always really powerful. So I guess with that in mind, is there an audience, a particular group that you know, once you write a book, it's out there. Anybody can pick it up. Anybody can read it and make it their own. But is there a particular group that you very much want to read The Dark Lady specifically, and for what reason?
I think it's challenging because a novel is a big task in and of itself. So generally, it's going to be the kind of teenagers who are already reading. It's not like comic books, maybe short stories, maybe even poetry, where you're going to probably engage new readers, even though I'd love to. So it is going to be teenagers who are already reading, or at least who already can read pretty well. But I'd like to reach, you know, a broader base of teenagers if I can, or teenagers who've neglected their reading. You know, I do a lot of work in prisons, for example. I was a judge on the Prison Reform Writers Trust competition for about 11 years. And it was very clear to me that, as I knew anyway from my own experience growing up, from my own friend group, and from, like I said, lots of work in prisons, that lots of young people who are in prison and read perfectly fine, and write perfectly fine, just for whatever reason life has taken them in that particular direction. So it would be good to reach young people who are probably not as reading as much, because they're not in formation, for example. So that would be good to do. I'm aware that it's a form that is very rarely someone's first step on the ladder in a way, if that makes sense. If someone isn't reading regularly, the chance that they're going to pick up a 300-page novel and go for that is probably quite slim, but it'll be nice to do some of that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm thinking about how in Natives you contextualize yourself as a case study of a particular era of British history, of colonialism, of migration. And I want to focus now on Henry, who's a protagonist in The Dark Lady. How is Henry, even though he's a fictional character, a case study of Elizabethan England?
Yeah, I suppose he does try to be that in a way. Even though I'm not sure there are very many orphans from this, or self-perceived orphans, because he's not an orphan in the end, that emerged from the slums of Elizabethan London that ended up, you know, as part of the aristocracy, or at least rolling with the aristocracy. But funny enough, you know, there was racism back then, obviously, and there was specifically anti-black racism, with blackness being associated with the devil, evil, and actually with the Islamic conquerors of Muslim Spain, Al-Andalus, that, you know, wasn't that far in the past in the period that we're talking about. So it's only 1492 when the Islamic conquest is finally expelled from Spain. You know, we're only 100 years after that here. So I also tried, like I said, I tried not to project back all of this later history. A lot of the prejudice in Britain at the time, so some of the events that occur in there, the stuff that happens with the Dutch church, the kind of, you know, foreigners in general, there, that was real. Immigrants from Europe were treated very, very poorly in London at the time. There was all sorts of anti-immigrant, anti-foreigner sentiment. And the main riots were against workers from Belgium, what today would be Belgium. And so I've tried to show that actually, yes, there was a specific variant of anti-black, specific to black people, and was specifically based on skin color. And that racism is part of what fed transatlantic slavery, or at least fed the justifications for it. But there was a wider bias against foreigners, and there was obviously horrendous living conditions of the average poor person. And in a way, it's not hugely dissimilar to today, where because Britain isn't a settler colony like the United States or South Africa, Britain didn't export apartheid all over the world, but didn't apartheid, formal apartheid on its own domestic soil. The relationship between the class system and general prejudice against foreigners and between racism against black people specifically is even today in Britain quite complex in a way. Growing up, English Jamaicans, for example, yes, we had to deal with institutionalized racism from the police and the schools, but we were also in many ways the culturally dominant force of any ethnic group growing up in London. So we had a certain cultural cachet that other immigrant groups didn't have, and that even in a way poor white kids didn't have. No disrespect. Nobody wanted to be the poor white kids in the same way. It wasn't their culture that was the dominant youth culture growing up in 1990s London. It was very much American rap music, Jamaican dancehall that was the dominant musical cultures, and that fed into the street slang everybody spoke, the fashion everybody had. And you see a similar thing today with the rise of Afrobeat, where when I was growing up, you know, West Africans were treated very, very poorly, in fact, even by Caribbeans. And whereas today, the rise of Nigerian music has kind of given Nigerian and West African culture a different sort of cachet in the street. And even if you look today, the biggest rappers in Britain are all of West African rather than Caribbean origin. Stormzy, Dave, Skepta, Dizzy Rascal, etc. And so that's really, really interesting. But yeah, Henry, I tried to show the times as best as I could through the eyes of somebody like Henry and what I thought it would have been like back then.
Just sticking with Henry for a bit longer, you know, you give him a very special gift that sets him apart. And not to give too much away, but it's a gift of literacy, right? That he has a way with words, but he also has this incredible power where he can decode words. Why did you want to give him those particular gifts? What's the significance of that?
Yeah, great question. I mean, reading is a superpower. It's something we take for granted today because we're lucky enough to live at a time where whatever else is wrong with today, literacy, especially in wealthy countries, is widespread. School is mandatory. And so we forget that really up until even 100 years ago, only a tiny amount of people could read and write. And if you go back any further, you know, a tiny elite could read and write. It was controlled knowledge. The first man to translate the Bible into English, for example, was burned at the stake. You know, a man called William Tyndale. And only a few decades later, anyway, his translation becomes the basis of the King James Version of the Bible, because by then it was politically possible to translate the Bible into English. But reading has always been tremendously, tremendously important. Control of knowledge has always been tremendously important. And even today in Britain, we have this sort of culture where it's sort of marketed to working class kids that it's a bit cool and edgy to not care about school, to not compete academically. And it's seen as kind of corny almost to be smart. And I've always wanted to rail against that. And so giving Henry, a tough kid from the street, who's been through certain things, who is boisterous, who can fight, but also giving him a real life of the mind and an intellectual gift, this is something I really wanted to do, and a kind of character I would have wanted to read when I was growing up. I never bought into this sort of caricature that young men from the street are basically ineducable savages, because that's not what I saw. It's not what I saw among my friend group. It wasn't my experience. It wasn't my experience even of my uncles and cousins who did do terribly bad things in the street. People are complex, philosophical, emotional, creative creatures, until that's beaten out of them by some process or other. So I kind of really wanted to show that with Henry.
You also do something which is interesting, which is you show how this superpower is a wonderful gift. It's also the means by which he becomes elevated to the aristocracy, though it's a very conditional kind of entrance into that world. You know, it's a lot what happens to him there. And then internally, he has this conflict where he actually, I found this quite interesting. You allowed him to enjoy and become compromised, right? And to actually betray people.
Absolutely.
And you did it in a way that was not judgmental. It's quite transparent. He's, you know, actually going through the mental mathematics of why he should be allowed to enjoy these nice clothes, et cetera, et cetera. I feel like that's obviously quite intentional, right? Am I on the right track here, that you wanted to show this kind of, I don't want to use the word selling out, but it is like he gets compromised. He gets lulled and he leaves people behind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I deliberately and very much wanted to show that, because I think even if it's not intentional, you know, I'm not a proper Marxist. There are things about Marx with whom I disagree. I don't treat Marx as the Bible, as some people do. And I definitely don't necessarily agree with a lot of the sort of politics that have come out of that today. But why, you know, the idea that material existence informs consciousness is something with which I very much agree. Your material position, for good or ill, will inform a lot of the way you view the world. If you're hungry, it's pretty hard to think about abstract principles because you're hungry and all you can think about is hunger. Poverty makes people do things they otherwise would not do if they were not poor. I saw that with my own family growing up. And I've seen that transition as my family's been less poor and then really not meaningfully poor in any way. And I think it's a contradiction whether people admit it or not, or whether people are even conscious of it. Because often people are not conscious of it, right? So for example, we take some of the political debates, right? Western university graduates speaking about the rich, for example, as an abstract category separate from themselves is true in the context of a rich Western country. But if most university graduates from Britain or Australia went to where my cousins come from in Jamaica and started talking about the rich as if they were a separate group of people, my cousins would just laugh at them. Because, of course, in an island where the average wage is $2,000 to $4,000 a year, someone who can even afford to be there, to take that flight, who has a passport that can get them to different countries, from the perspective of someone in the Jamaican ghetto, that person is rich. It doesn't make a difference to them that you're struggling by the standards of Britain, by their standards. And Jamaica's not even a genuinely poor country. Jamaica's a middle-income country. We were talking about Congo or India or somewhere. And I always say this because I've worked in so many places around the world and had to navigate what I am in different spaces. Obviously, in England, I'm what we would classify as a mixed-race road, which everyone understands what that is in England. Mixed-race boys in England, boys who've got one black parent, one white parent, generally occurred at the bottom end of the social scale. And we all generally understand that prison is very common for that group of people, and there's certain stereotypes attached to that group of people. And they're racialized as black. In the Caribbean, people who look like me are mostly aristocracy because of the apartheid that was put in place. Light-skinned people could inherit property and all that sort of stuff long before fully black people and so on. And that's led to a completely different behavior of that group and political worldview of that group because they have material. Similarly, the Irish in England, we had a lot of affinity with the Irish in England. Caribbeans and the Irish had a really strong affinity because the Irish were the one group of white people that were discriminated against based on ethnicity, not just class. So they understood where we were coming from perhaps more than other white groups did. Whereas the Irish in America, as I write about in Natives, very much became part of the sort of white supremacist establishment. And I say all of that to say this, that as much as we all like to think, or at least I'd hope we like to think, you know, that we make our own decisions, which we do to a point, and free will and all that sort of stuff, all of this is informed by your own experiences. And I think that the UK rap scene right now is a really interesting example of this, and probably part of the inspiration behind Henry's transition in a way, is seeing so much money come into UK rap music. I was actually at an event last night, a big gala, which for one of the online, the main online sort of platform for UK rap music, and seeing how money has changed people. And sadly, mostly for the better. What I mean by that is, a lot of young brothers from the street who come from really tough environments, many of whom have been to prison, been shot, been stabbed, once they get a bit of resource security, which is a better way I'd like to put it, you know, own a home maybe, can afford to travel maybe, have these accoutrements of middle class or upper middle class upbringing, and all of a sudden, the street doesn't look so attractive. And all of a sudden, the problems they have with the guys from across the road over which people have died now don't seem so important. And they actually, there's a phrase in rap music called don't F up the money, right? Don't mess up the money. And in a way, material resources become gangster rappers sending their kids to private school, right? And all these kind of things that people wouldn't think go with the stereotype of what these young men would be. And so I wanted to give Henry a bit of that. I like flawed characters. I don't like characters that are proxies for particular sets of values or ideas and that are completely unflawed, because I don't believe anybody's like that. I believe even if we look at people that are enormously politically principled, often when you look at their personal lives or the way family members were treated or any of that sort of stuff, you always find contradiction in every human being. Even the people we may create messiahs of because politically they really were willing to die for a particular set of principles, so willing to make the ultimate sacrifice, you'll still find on a personal level there is ego, there is ambition, there is mistreatment of other people, and even among friends, sometimes it's not even betrayal. Again, life can create different interests among people. And so I wanted it to be realistic. I mean, we live in modern welfare state societies where the chance of starving to death is basically non-existent. There is a hunger that existed in this period of time. Starvation was a very real possibility. People were still starving to death in London at this time. So if you took a child from that reality and gave them Spanish leather shoes, and coat of an aristocracy, and all this kind of stuff, the chance that they would not get a bit gassed by that is just impossible. It's like you take the average kid from the hood today, not university graduates, because I think university graduates often, there's an amount of cultural and intellectual capital that comes with getting a degree where perhaps people will not feel, first of all, going to university in the first place, you must feel a certain level of self-confidence. But also, once you go through that process, there's a certain level of cultural capital that people feel fulfilled in a way, even if it hasn't led to the material benefits that they would like. The young boys I work with in the street, every single one of them, be enormously impressed by someone who drove a Rolls Royce or someone who drove a Mercedes or whatever else. If Raheem Sterling comes to the neighborhood in his Rolls Royce, the whole neighborhood's going to come to a standstill. Be like, rah, and respect and admire his material gain, even if it's just as a proxy for, you know, living vicariously through him. And so I also wanted to sort of represent honestly what I believe to be the way often people from the underclass view money and material gain, not the sort of student union politics, which I think are quite different. And I think that's one of the clashes at the moment politically, is that university graduates understandably maybe have a certain set of ideas and can think in abstractions and have been taught to think in abstractions. That's very, very important. But I would say to a lot of left-wing university graduates, which I always do, just go and test those ideas in the barbershop, where you know non-university educated manual laborers congregate, which is supposed to be your target audience if you're a lefty anyway. You just go and test those ideas. And often what you'll find is there's a practical socialism, for want of a better word, i.e. there's mutual aid. If you're supposed to give back, you're supposed to help people. Whether people like it or not, the average brother in the barbershop admires getting rich. And that's one of the contradictions here, right? And I think so I've tried to show that when I was growing up, the young brothers in the street who made money, they were the people we most admired. And they made money the wrong way. It's not like they did what Henry did and translated a few books. These are people that did really bad things in the street to make money. And we all admired them and wanted to be like them. And so I tried to show a little bit of that, that poverty creates in people a real poverty, a desperation so, so bad that the moment you're not poor anymore, and not being poor anymore. And in a way, I think a lot of people from the slum in particular see people that come from their neighborhood that get rich as one of their own that made it, kind of thing. We see this with footballers, we see it with rappers. And so I wanted to show that more. And I thought it would be better if he sort of just became rich and was very Buddhist about it and it didn't affect his internal equilibrium at all. I think he would have been a less interesting, less complicated, and less endearing human being. I think we can all see a little bit of ourselves in Henry. It would be easy. I would say to him, you know, it'd be lovely to just, you know, sit on a beach in Thailand for the rest of my life, you know, sipping cocktails. But there's part of my spirit that compels me to want to make a difference, even though it would be much more fun for me personally. And I think it's important to admit that we desire those things. Of course, it's nice to go on holiday. Of course, even if people don't want a nice car or a Bentley or flashy clothes, everybody wants some nice things. It might be a holiday. It might be a yoga retreat. It might be 10-pound blood orange juice, right? But we all desire nice things in a way, no matter what our political views are. And that was a really, really long answer. But, yeah, so I tried to pick out a lot of that through Henry's character, through Henry's transition to riches.
I appreciate a long answer. I enjoy a long answer. Just to take it a bit further, just let's make it a bit longer. So you have all these complicated ideas and then you put them in front of a young audience. What's the significance and the importance of doing that specific act?
Because I think teenagers are much smarter than we give them credit for often. And I think if you look at a lot of the, you know, the YA books that are out there now, I think maybe adults are the ones who don't realize that. I'll give you an example. I was a judge on the YA Prize, I can't remember the actual name of the prize. It's like the biggest YA prize in England a couple of years ago. Embarrassing that the name's forgotten me, but never mind. I was a judge on that prize a couple of years ago. And it was really interesting because they brought teenagers in as judges as well. And seeing the difference between what the adults thought teenagers wanted to read, teenagers should read, teenagers would relate to, and what the teenagers thought was night and day. Now, obviously, these were very bright teenagers. I mean, I had to read 14 novels or 12 novels or whatever the shortlist was. So they were extremely smart children. But they were from, you know, state schools, and there were a range of kids. It wasn't all privileged kids. You could just tell. We know that as Londoners, by the way they talk, by the way they move, etc. But they clearly had a very solid grasp on really, really complex ideas, had thought very deeply about the world and family life and all of these other things. And so I wouldn't dream of writing something for teenagers that didn't take on those things, because this is the age at which you start to form your beliefs about certain things. Now, that can change 20 times through the course of the next few decades, but this is the first time, obviously, when you're 9 or 10, you know, you can't really quite yet have, you know, seriously deep thoughts about politics and economics because you're 9, right? You can have it a bit, but it's really this, you know, 12 to 16 is where that starts coming into being. It's where you, when I was nine, I didn't understand that my family was poor, really. When I look back now, when I became a teenager, I really understood what that meant. When I was nine, we just didn't have certain things. I hadn't really conceptualized, oh, I'm poor and they're rich. Even when we think about ethnicity, one of the things I write about a lot in Natives was as you become teenagers is when you become socialized into what it means to be a black boy in London. When I was 9 or 10, I was friends with everybody. I was friends with the girls. I was friends with, because I grew up in a very multi-ethnic neighborhood. I was friends with boys from all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds and class backgrounds. I was friends with the rich white kids from the top of the hill. And I was friends with the guys who came from Sudan or elsewhere. And then as we became teenagers, all of the different black immigrant groups, remember, we're in England, so it's not like black Americans where there's a coherent, shared half a millennia almost of history. We're talking about groups of people who migrated in the last generation, whose parents migrated or grandparents in, from 25 different countries around the world. And yet we become in Britain during these teenage years, black boys, become defined primarily by race more than any other factor. And that happens as teenagers. And so I wanted to try and tackle some of that, even though in the form of a novel, this sort of coming of age and this figuring out the world and your first love and losing your virginity, so on and so, the first time you have sex, etc. All of these confusing things that are happening, along with figuring out why the world is the way it is. And finally realizing that adults are nutters. You know what I mean? Like when you're 9, 10 years old, you think adults are great and they've really got it all figured out and they know everything and they're really, really smart. And then you become a teenager and realize these people they're psychopaths. They're wonderful too, but they're nutters. And I think when you realize that adults are nutters as a teenager, you don't quite yet realize though, you're just naive enough to think that you're going to be so much different and that your generation is going to be the generation that realizes, like you realize the world is the way it is. And it's beautiful that teenagers believe and younger people believe they're going to, you know, realize this enormous change. We need that because if we aim here, we might just about reach here. Whereas if we don't aim to change anything at all, we won't achieve anything. And so we need the idealism of the young. We need the naivety of the young. We need the ambition and the energy of really, really young people to achieve any meaningful change at all. Even if the things that's often you believe when you're 16, 17, 18, 22, you don't believe in quite the same way when you're 40, because the intervening 20 years teaches you just how hard it is to actually achieve anything. On a personal note for me, just writing these two books, it's been so unbelievably hard that my conception of Tolstoy or Chekhov or Shakespeare or Toni Morrison has completely, my understanding of the level they were really at, it has changed. And my appreciation of hard work has changed. You know, as a musician, I get to collaborate and work with loads of other people. And so in a way, I get to offshore some of the responsibility. When you make an album as an artist, unless you're Prince or D'Angelo or someone and you can play all of the instruments, and even then, you've still got someone else mixing the record, someone else mastering the record, someone else doing the photography. As a novelist, all right, you've got your editor, but it's pretty much just you. Right. And you've got to be the director of the film because you've got to decide where the camera is positioned and what the audience sees, what's the angle they see from. You've got to edit. You've got to decide when to cut and when to leave a scene. You've got to obviously be the writer. And then you've got to embody all these different characters. So you've got to be an actor too. And whether you succeed or fail in that endeavor, just being able to, or to what degree you succeed or fail in the eyes of other people, just being able to write something that's even readable over 300 pages or 200 is extremely difficult, as anyone who's ever tried to do it knows. And so I feel an enormous sense of achievement from that. But really, I think you don't know any of that when you're a teenager or when you're 20, just how difficult any of that stuff is, just how difficult it is to do anything, just what it takes to become a surgeon or an architect or any of those sorts of things. And so, yes, I wanted to deal with really, really tough ideas. And all of what it means to be that age in a way. But obviously, if you're that age and you come from the kind of background Henry does, or to an extent even the kind of background I do, there's also a certain cynicism, which again, people who've had slightly more stable and comfortable upbringings probably have a bit more of the naivety and idealism than somebody like I would have, because the problems in my own family alone were enough to teach me very, very early that the world is a really tough place. I mean, when I look at my cousins, even more so. Now, I was the lucky one. My dad wasn't in prison. My dad wasn't killed. One of my cousins' dad was killed. One died very suspiciously in police custody. Another one died a paranoid schizophrenic in relation to stuff that happened in the street. One's addicted to drugs, so on and so forth. I mean, really, really awful starts in life. Basically, all of my closest cousins got. Even though my parents weren't together, they were teenage parents. My dad grew up in care. So it wasn't exactly the best upbringing. My mom was kicked out of the house as a teenager. In the scheme of my family, me and my siblings were the lucky ones. And so in a way, even though Henry has that idealism of a teenager, because of the kind of background he's from, him, Mary, all of them, they have that cynicism too. Because they've been exposed to the fact they could starve to death any winter. They've had to steal to survive. They've had to risk being hung as children just to eat. Now, of course, we don't have that level of extremity in Britain today. But teenage kids are really exposed to some really awful, really tough, really grim stuff. The greater the extent to which you've been exposed to that stuff, you probably will have a bit more of a hard-nosed, realist view of the world than someone who's been lucky enough to have, you know, two professional parents and go to a lovely school and go skiing every summer. And my school was an embodiment of that. We had those kids in our school, and they did view the world a lot differently to the way we did because they could. And that comes back to the last point we made about sort of material conditions informing the way you view the world.
We know that writing is hard in the best of circumstances, but what was it like writing? How much harder was it writing during a pandemic? Did you feel like it's lonely? Writing is a lonely process. Is it extra lonely when you're doing it in a pandemic?
Yes. So Dark Lady, I didn't write. Dark Lady was meant to come out a year before it has done.
Okay.
So we originally put it back. So I actually didn't write any of this I have been writing during the pandemic, so I can speak to that. But I didn't write Dark Lady during the pandemic because actually it's already been delayed by a whole year. It was meant to come out, what year are we in now, 2020? So it was meant to come out 2019. So I actually wrote it in 2018. But having been still writing and creating, I've actually been writing music for the last year during the pandemic. Everything's lonely when there's a lockdown or when you can't leave your house or when you can't travel. All of that sort of stuff is difficult. But you know what? Writing is this kind of writing we're talking about, not music. But writing itself is so lonely. I think that aspect of it, pandemic or no pandemic, like it's there are times when you're working on a book where you think, why do I do this to myself? This is torture. Like 8 hours a day in a room on your own, no friends, don't talk to me. You know, when you're having a bad day as a writer, it's not like other professions. You know what I liken it to? Because I used to be a professional athlete. I played soccer for West Ham for 5 years. I don't know. I don't know whether you guys call it football or soccer in America because of Australian rules.
Okay. I'm being told we call it soccer in Australia. Because we've got football
So I played football for five years. I stopped just before professional level, but I played at a professional club. And you're forced as an athlete to confront your own inadequacy every single day that you go to training, every single time you go to play a game, unless you're like Lionel Messi or somebody, right? Unless you're extraordinarily gifted, which is one in, and look, to even play for a pro club, you have to be extraordinarily gifted. But then there's gifted and there's gifted. And that's when you get to play for a professional club where everybody's the best in their neighborhood, everybody's the best in their school, because you wouldn't have even got there in the first place. And you're now average. You've gone from being by far the best player in your school, maybe even in your district, maybe even in your neighbor, maybe even in your county. And now you're with all of the other young boys who were also the best of their bunch, and you're just average. And there might be one guy out of all of that who's exceptionally brilliant. So you're forced to confront that you're not that great every day, and that's how you improve. In a way, writing is similar. It's not like other professions. Every single day, you're forced to confront, am I good enough? Can I do this? Do I have the ideas? Do I have the chops? And some days you're like, of course I do. This is wonderful. This is all going great. Boom. And you're just in the zone. But you're lucky if you get two of those a month. People think writing is really glamorous. The other 28 is just hard work. It's just you and the laptop and eking it out and changing and figuring it out. And then you get two flashes of inspiration a month. And so lonely at the best of times. That I'm not sure how much difference a pandemic makes to the writing part. It makes a difference to all the other extra parts that make the writing part more bearable. But I don't think it made a huge difference to that part.
I know you're a big history geek. Anybody who reads your writing knows that you love history. You go on your TikTok, you're giving history lectures there. This book, obviously, steeped in history. Can you talk a little bit about your research into slang, your research into London at that time? Where did you go? What kind of resources were there for you to find out how very, very, very poor people lived during that time and also the origins of the slang words that you use?
Yeah, amazing. Thanks. What was great is because the Elizabethan era, if this was a different era I'd pick, it would have been much more difficult. The Elizabethan era has become, in a way, along with the Industrial Revolution, but in a way, the sort of foundational myth of Britain. You know, the Queen Elizabeth as this particular monarch. Obviously, it's the time of Shakespeare. Literacy has just become reasonably widespread by the standards of the time. So there is such an enormous cachet of documents, such an enormous wealth of stuff. I mean, there's literally a book called A Time Traveler's Guide to Elizabethan London. And it's literally that. It's designed to help you understand what people wore, what people ate, drank, what it smelt like, where people frequent. I mean, it's absolutely meticulous, brilliant. So there isn't, I mean, that same scholar, Ian Mortimer, has done one for medieval Britain. There are a few other books like that, but it's a really original book because it's almost as if it was designed for people who want to write historical fiction. Like, it literally tells you this is what people wore, this is what they ate. Actually, they didn't eat what you think they ate. The English diet back then was much better than we imagine. There's this thing about the English not being able to cook. It's a thing, especially immigrants to Britain. We came here and we're like, we don't season their food as much. Except, as I say, we came here, I was born here. Like my grandmother, that was one of the things that shocked her. Kinds of spices and seasoning that she'd been used to in Jamaica just were not widespread here. And obviously the migration to Britain has massively enriched that side of the culture. But actually in Elizabethan London, the food they ate was much more like, at least if you could afford it, was much more like what we think of as Moroccan food today than what we think of as English food. They had all sorts of wonderful spices. The rich obviously were importing great spices for themselves. They were eating couscous and all sorts of stuff you just wouldn't think, cooking with prunes. So immediately that's that banquet they have in at the Duke's. Partly what I was inspired to do that just because people would be surprised that that's how people ate. They imagined the English diet was basically just a slab of meat and some potatoes back then. And so lots of those little nerdy details in there about what people were wearing were from that particular book. But then there's two great books called The Elizabethan Underworld by two different scholars that are both about the Elizabethan Underworld. One of which has an enormous dictionary, way bigger than the one I have. So I've just reprinted a small version of this Elizabethan Dictionary of Elizabethan Street Slang based on the words I actually used. But that scholar's book has a massive dictionary of Elizabethan street slang. Then I read a lot of the poems from the time. So they had these like bawdy poems about prostitution and violence and robbery and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of those are available. So I had a whole volume of those. And in fact, in the back of the book, I make a note on sort of the best books I read researching for the era, or at least the ones that were most useful. Loads of the mainstream stuff. So I think for this era, it would be much easier than if you picked probably an era at which there is less scholarship and less has been written. Where you'd probably need to go to primary sources yourself as if you were researching for a PhD and go and look at primary source documents. Whereas for this one, that wasn't as necessary other than the primary source documents of Shakespeare or Marlowe or these poems that I was talking about, because there is such a wealth of great stuff written about Elizabethan London. But it was really fun.
As you go around London these days, read the city differently? Like, do you notice things or just understand your sense of place differently?
Absolutely. I think that one of the challenges, I suppose, of populations that migrate to another country, particularly if there's a background of colonialism to that, where you know you're migrating essentially to the country that conquered the country that you come from. One of the really difficult things is ownership. Who gets the right to belong? Who gets to feel British? And how complicated does that become by this history? And I've tried to walk that line really, really carefully, because on the one hand, obviously, I'm obviously extremely critical of both ongoing and previous waves of colonialism. I still feel that my sort of British foreign policy is a tremendous danger to Britain and to the world, because I think that the British ruling class are more concerned with projecting military power than global safety and all this nonsense about human rights and democracy and all this other crap. It's stuff they don't even say privately when they're talking to one another. If you look at the documents, you know, military experts write when they're talking to one another, they don't consider all that sort of stuff. They consider power and the balance of power in the world and pragmatic, hard-nosed concerns. The stuff about spreading human rights and democracy is just for the liberal public to feel good about colonizing elsewhere. But I say that to say this, I still think it's important that children who are born here, who grow up here, who have to make a life here, to have some sense of the place in which they do, the good and the bad, the achievements and a lot of the way Britain has managed, again, because Britain isn't a settler colony, a lot of the British class system, which obviously affects racialized groups even more, but nonetheless is still a class system, has its roots in this era. This is when it begins to be formed. And so there's so much of, and because some of these buildings are still there, you know, some of the palaces are still there, the old city of London is still there. You can almost feel and taste and think about what it was like back then. Some of the street names are still there, you know, and speak so much to history. And so I think having that entitlement to have a sense of the history, while not abandoning its complications and its less pleasant aspects, I think is really, really important in a way. But yes, absolutely, doing that much research about that period. There are certain streets I walk on now in the old city of London where I just, it means more to me. And I literally immediately think about 500 years ago. My brain just goes there. When I go down to where the Globe is now, or Lombard Street or Threadneedle Street and all those little old city of London places, I wonder where the French Quarter was from here, because there was a French Quarter back then and all that sort of stuff. So it has, definitely given that part of London a different flavor. Obviously, the rest of London, including the part of London that I live in, that didn't exist. It was all countryside back then. So it's only, weirdly enough, it's only that part of London. If I'm in West London or North London, I never get that sense of half a millennia of history, because that was all countryside. But the moment I'm down in the city of London, I get that sense.
Why did you choose to give Henry's mother a backstory in Benin? Why that country specifically?
Great question. I'm not sure why I picked Benin, if I'm honest. Like, there were a number of West African kingdoms at the time. No, actually, I think I do know why I picked Benin, because Benin was probably the most sophisticated of the Atlantic West African countries at the time, by which I mean the ones that were on the Atlantic coast. So Islamic, medieval Islamic Africa, you know, had enormous libraries. So Timbuktu, place that people often think is like fictional, was a real place, still is a real place. But you know, the libraries of Timbuktu, there's 750,000 handwritten manuscripts surviving from the 12th, 13th, 14th century till today. So Islamic Africa was part of the broader spread of Islamic civilization in a way. Not to say that that means it isn't African, because of course it is. African Muslims are just as African as anyone else. But I think I picked Benin precisely because, A, she would have to travel through Timbuktu. Also, because it was an indigenous African civilization and society in a way. And it was the society that was most successful at protecting its own citizens from the slave trade. A lot of people don't know that. The Great Wall of Benin was about four times the length of the Great Wall of China. It wasn't as sophisticated in terms of construction. It wasn't made from as difficult materials and probably didn't require quite the same level of engineering, but it nonetheless speaks to the level of organization that 10,000 miles of walling could be put up in West Africa 600-700 years ago. The wall may be even older than that. It's destroyed now. There's some tiny parts of it left, but it was destroyed during invasion and so on and so forth. And so it's always, and obviously the Benin bronzes are in the British Museum. It's always been a really fascinating kingdom to me. I thought about Othello a lot, and where Shakespeare would have gotten the inspiration from that character. I know there was an Italian version of the play that is believed that he read. There's an Italian version, iteration of that story. And one of the things scholars talk about is Shakespeare's version of this character, this blackamoor character, is much more humane and rounded and less of a caricature and the Italian version. I haven't read the Italian play. I'm just saying what other scholars have said about the comparison between the two. But, you know, I just always wondered, where did he come from? You know, is he a North African Berber? Is he Amazigh? Is he from West Africa? And so I just felt like giving her this backstory rooted in Benin at a time when, you know, in the middle of the 17th century, the Portuguese try to invade the Kingdom of the Congo and they lose. Because at that point, the military chasm that opened up between Europeans and Africans in the 19th century was much, much smaller. You know, the whatever firearms Europeans had were not particularly sophisticated. So if you look at what West African armies had then versus the caricature some people think they might have had, these people had bronze weapons, casted bronze weapons, right? Swords, really, really lethal weaponry. And so I wanted to show a bit of that sophistication that wasn't necessarily connected to the larger Arabic-speaking civilizations further north in Songhai or Gao or Mali. So I think all of those reasons, and obviously my background in African history, I thought this is a really interesting chance to sneak some African history in via the back door in the form of a novel without sort of beating young people over the head with it. You know, if I'm a young person reading that today, no matter what my ethnicity is, hopefully it will pique my interest in learning a little bit more about that side of the history. I didn't want it to be, even though I'm writing about Elizabethan London, I didn't want it to, it's hard with black characters, right? Because you don't want to try and make all of your black characters a proxy for black people in a way that, you know, white characters never have to be. White characters can be as flawed as they like and fully human and drug addicts and criminals and pedophiles and Mother Teresa and whatever else. They can run the full gamut of human expression without being seen as embodiments of an entire ethnic group. Ethnic minority characters and black characters in specifically have to sort of be representatives in a way. And even for a black audience, often if you write a black character that is flawed in a particular way, sometimes a black audience might accuse you of playing up to the stereotype or doing this or doing that, because unfortunately you have the job of representation in a way. And I try not to do that because I think it's not great for creativity. But I'm also conscious that in some ways it's inescapable. And so I felt like I had a chance to show some African history via using the history of Elizabethan London also and popularizing it hopefully for a young audience. And so all of those reasons were part of the motivation for trying to show some of the Benin background for the Dark Lady.
Speaking of Shakespeare, who you mentioned and who, you know, you are a big fan of, it's all the way through so much of your work. There seems to be a very special relationship between Shakespeare and Henry. Do you care to elaborate what that might be?
I deliberately left it open because politically I didn't want to take that relationship too far and necessarily make suggestions that clearly can't be backed up by the history. That said, we know that Shakespeare had an affair with this African woman. Presumably she's an African woman, at least from the way Shakespeare's written about her. Scholars have taken to calling her the Dark Lady, and even that's an interesting choice, because Shakespeare calls her black over and over again. That's the only thing he ever refers to her as. He never refers to her as a dark lady. He refers to her as black. And so we may not ever quite find...
Do you think there would be like a cultural wringing of hands if you were very overt about that? Like, do you think that there would be like outrage and tearing of garments and like, how could he do that? Kind of, how dare Akala? If you were explicit?
Not anymore. Yeah, not anymore, because politically, I don't think it's possible for people to do that anymore. If it was 10 years ago, you know, for all of as much as people lambast political correctness or whatever they want to call it, and as much as I disagree with some of the more silly iterations of what I'd call sort of liberal identity politics, which I mean genuinely, I don't mean it the way right wing people mean it. I mean where it just gets silly and isn't based in evidence or has no class analysis or is concerned with things that only extremely privileged people can even afford to be concerned with anyway, right? So I have some criticism of some of that, but as much as we may lambast some of it, it has created an environment in which being offended at the suggestion that Shakespeare had a black mistress is no longer really politically possible for people. It just makes you look racist, because why would you be offended by that if that's what the evidence suggests, which is what the evidence suggests. And if we know that there were black people living in London at the time, for a fact, then it's not entirely inconceivable, is it? And why would that somehow, people have to unpick for themselves, why would that dampen Shakespeare's brilliance as a writer for you? What is it you're saying about yourself that you think the fact that if he had an affair with a black woman, that we know he had plenty of affairs, right? So why would even having an affair with a black woman change how you feel about his writing or his place in history? What is your conception of Britain as a sort of lily white place at any point before 1948? It just simply isn't supported by the evidence. London was a city of immigrants 500 years ago. That's just a simple fact. Funnily enough, the Shakespeare and Henry relationship, originally, it was sort of even closer. And some of the stuff that the Duke is doing as a character came, and even Graham, came via Shakespeare. It just didn't work. Shakespeare wouldn't do it for me. It felt forced to make him too much of a mentor for Henry. It felt trite, and I just had to rewrite a lot of it. It just wouldn't work. Graham's relationship with him just felt more authentic. And in a way, even the Duke, you know, as much of an unkind guy the Duke is, for me, at least, his relationship with Henry worked more than trying to make Shakespeare do too much of that. We know Shakespeare has a soft spot for Henry. We don't yet find out why. We may find out why in the future.
Well, we're coming very close to the end of our chat. So, Akala, maybe let's leave with a bit of a teaser. You end The Dark Lady with, you know, we're on the horizon of another adventure. So how many more books in the series are you planning? And what are your generally, without giving too much away, your plans for this character, Henry?
I can't say too much. But, you know, I'd love to see something visually. So I'd love to see it adapted for the screen at some point. There definitely will be another book. I don't know whether there'll be books plural, you know, we'll see. But obviously Henry is on the verge of another adventure. When that will be, I can't say, because you know how these things go. You know, things take time, and obviously I'm juggling. I'm writing another book, but I'm actually not writing The Dark Lady now at the moment, another Dark Lady. So I have another book to complete before I can actually finish Dark Lady book two. So another nonfiction. As well as music stuff to do and so on and so forth. So when book two will be, I cannot say just yet. But there will be more from Henry at some point.
Well, you're leaving him on quite a precipice, and we're all going to have to wait for a couple of years, it sounds like. So,
that sounds
good. Akala, I want to thank you so much for talking to you. Yeah, you're leaving us sort of on the edge here. Thank you so much for this chat today. Akala's new YA novel is called The Dark Lady. You can buy the book via the online bookshop at the Melbourne Writers Festival website, and the books are sold via the festival's bookshop partner, Readings. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this digital event at the Melbourne Writers Festival. Thank you for your support. I'm Beverly Wang. This has been Akala. Akala, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.